I have heard of beautiful cities far off in the land of the blessed, but in the only cities I've ever known, the weary get no rest. I have heard of beautiful mansions far up in the azure sky, but the only mansions I've ever known were not for you.
From Colorado and today Baton Rouge, Louisiana and Harlem, New York, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist. His name is Jonathan Clements, and we're going to be talking about who pays more taxes, the rich or the poor, and the answer may surprise you. There's quite a debate out there, and it's just kind of how you interpret it. You'll enjoy that, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about an issue in Congress for which I'm having trouble making up my mind, and it's the renewal of something called the Export-Import Bank. And the Export-Import Bank is kind of like government-sponsored financing of U.S. exports to foreign countries. So, for example, if I wanted to sell a cell phone system to a third world country, the country may not have access to traditional lenders to pay for it. So the U.S. government would then step in and provide financing assistance so the third world country could buy my company's products. And, you know, it's said to create jobs, and the government has provided close to $600 billion in financing over the last 80 years. And they say that it generates a surplus for the government and for the economy. So I don't know what to think on that. The Export-Import Bank is supposed to help open small U.S. firms to foreign markets by giving them access to capital the banks wouldn't typically provide. However, the truth is that 80% of the Export-Import Bank funds, well, they go to large firms like Boeing and General Electric, you know, to sell airplanes and large items to foreign countries. It generates jobs, but it's not the small business friend that it is proclaimed to be, although many small businesses are helped. The argument to save the Export-Import Bank is that, well, if we don't provide the financing for these projects and these sales, and if we don't get the jobs, well, then China will do it. And China often sells, you know, crappy stuff to impoverished nations using cheap credit as an inducement, much like a cheap furniture store. You know, they'll say, hey, you know, buy our furniture at this price and get 0% interest for 2 years. Well, China does the same thing. And I know that they sold a cell phone system to, I believe it was either Somalia or Ethiopia, and it turned out to be absolute garbage, where people had to walk for miles just to get a signal. But they offered cheap credit. You know, I guess third world nations are the same as unsophisticated shoppers who buy cheap stuff, or buy stuff because it's cheap, or they get free financing. But I'm not confident in the argument using China as a boogeyman. China is absolutely loaded with debt already. It can't finance the shaky governments of the world. So when Export-Import Bank or globalists say, hey, someone has to build the roads and infrastructure, why not us? Why should the Chinese get it? Well, that seems to be a fool's argument designed to prey upon people's fears. You know, much like when you're a kid growing up, well, if you don't do it, someone else will. It doesn't work anymore. I think it's time to examine a bigger picture. First, why can't we just have fair trade nation by nation with allies without these corporate protectionist global trade organizations like World Trade Organization and the Trans-Pacific Partnership? I mean, why can't we just have a trade? You know, if we have an ally, say Australia, say, hey, you get rid of your tariffs, we'll get rid of ours, and we'll have good cooperation. Then we can go to Japan and do the same thing without creating a higher level of government which oversees global commerce. And the second item that we should examine, the big picture, is why should U.S. government step in to cover the risk that traditional bankers won't do? Should the taxpayers incur the thus far minimal risk? But what if these export-import bank loans, if they're so good, why doesn't J.P. Morgan Chase do them? So really, on this issue, I have many questions. I have few answers. The reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank comes before Congress in a few weeks. The Tea Party crowd is fighting it, and they might be right. I'm mixed feelings. I'm ambivalent. However, I would like to see there are alternatives to encourage trade besides, you know, the wearisome free trade that they claim the Ayn Rand market, the libertarian view, proclaiming free trade in an unfree world. Okay, when we come back, Jonathan Clements of the Wall Street Journal is here, and we're going to talk about who pays more taxes, the rich or the poor, here on the Tim Daney Show. We'll be right back.
Times that are going to be, but the only time I've ever known bad for you and me.
A good man, real people, clear thinking, enjoyable, quality talk, a new name, EgbertoWillies.com. He talks politics, he talks issues, and you can hear his radio shows and read his blog at EgbertoWillies.com. You can link to him here at Danahy.com. He's also part of CoffeePartyUSA.com's network. Or, if you can spell EgbertoWillies.com, you found a new voice you'll want to hear. EgbertoWillies.com.
I've heard of beautiful countries far off in the land of the dead.
Teddy Roosevelt said, of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth. This is why antitrust law and competition is essential to America's economic health. This is why the Organization for Competitive Markets works to reclaim competition for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across America. We believe our duty is to advocate a just role for government in the agricultural economy, an enforcer of rules necessary for markets that are fair, honest, and accessible. The Organization for Competitive Markets. Learn more at competitivemarkets.com.
Countries I've ever known, the poor and hungry lack bread.
Welcome back to the Tim Daney Show here at Danahy.com, and nothing gets people worked up like perceived tax injustice. Facts are flying all over the place to justify differing positions. And it kind of reminds me of Homer Simpson's comment that he said, facts are meaningless. They can be used to prove anything. And yet some politicians, you know, they say that the rich pay all the taxes and that poor people are getting a free ride. And then meanwhile, others say the poor pay too much and the rich need to be paying more. And so who's right? And so who are you going to call? Well, this show calls the guy that knows the best. Wall Street journalist, personal finance columnist, and author of his own money guide, Jonathan Clements. And Jonathan, welcome back to the Tim Daney Show.
It's great to be on again, Tim.
Well, it's always good to have you here because I get worked up about everything, but, you know, you always come across as the voice of reason and curse you for having the right facts and doing it in such a balanced way. It just makes my job so much easier.
Today we're going to be tackling the tough one, at least tough in terms of being complicated, but somehow or other I hope that we can help people to get their arms around the tax code. And when I look at the tax code, it is, at first blush, utterly baffling. I mean, you think about all the different taxes that we pay, sales taxes, property taxes, Medicare and Social Security payroll taxes, capital gains taxes, the Medicare surtax, the income tax, the alternative minimum tax, and the estate tax. We're getting taxed all kinds of different ways, and it's hard to look at all of that and say, well, is it really a fair system or not? And that's, I think, the issue that we're really going to try and tackle over the next 20 minutes or so.
Well, that is, we will go over all of that. But the high income earners, you know, that you see that their tax rate is like 35% or something, and then you see the lower rate, lower income earners may have rates, let's make up a number, 10%. But that doesn't really tell the whole story, does it?
Absolutely not. I mean, first off the bat, we do have a progressive tax system. I mean, high-income earners not only pay more in tax, but they pay more as a percentage of their income than people with lower earnings. So, for instance, if you look at federal taxes paid, meaning not only income taxes but also payroll taxes, if you're making $1 million or more per year, you're paying about a third of that to the federal government in income taxes and payroll taxes. By contrast, if you get somebody who's, you know, sort of firmly in the upper middle class, they're making $75,000 to $100,000 a year. They would be paying about 18% of their income to the federal government in income taxes and payroll taxes. So, yeah, you know, overall, this is indeed a progressive tax system. Nonetheless, two of the biggest taxes that figure in the typical American's lives are actually regressive. And those two taxes are, one, the sales tax, which is a key way of financing state governments. Sales taxes hurt people on lower incomes more simply because they spend more of their income. They have to. That's how they get by. And then the other big regressive tax is the payroll tax. That's the Social Security and Medicare payroll tax. The Social Security portion of that is capped out at $118,500. And for the typical middle-class family, payroll tax is actually probably taking more of their income each year than federal income taxes. If you look at somebody who's making around $50,000 a year and got a couple of kids, they're likely paying more in payroll taxes every year than they are in federal income taxes. So two of the biggest taxes in our lives to the typical American are indeed regressive.
So, you know, I kind of want to keep a mental running counter, Jonathan, and that is, the payroll tax, Social Security and Medicare, whatever, that is about 8%, just to keep things going. They're also paying, you say, and I'm going to say 15% to try and say that tax bracket around $70,000 or so. So
yeah, let me
please
put you right on something, Tim, before you go any further. If you have a job, you've got wage income, you pay that 7.65% Social Security and Medicare payroll tax on every dollar you earn. Every single dollar you earn gets hit for that 7.65%. By contrast, even if you're in the 15% or even the 25% federal income tax bracket, that's only the tax that applies to the last few dollars of income you earn. Before you get there, you're going to have a bunch of income that doesn't get taxed at all because maybe you're putting money into a 401k plan or a tax-deductible IRA, so that money isn't taxed. Then you're going to have the money that's covered by your personal exemption and by your standard or itemized deduction. Those dollars aren't taxed under the income tax. Then you go through the 10% bracket. You have a portion of your income that's taxed 10%. Then you move up to the 15%. You get taxed a bunch of income at the 15%. And then finally you get to the 25% tax bracket. So even if you're in the 25% tax bracket, your actual percentage of your income that you're paying to the federal government may just be half that amount. Whereas with terms of the Social Security payroll tax, every dollar you earn gets taxed at that 7.65%.
Well, just to kind of illustrate, you know, again, make it simple for me, is that, you know, if you're making $100,000 and you're taxed at 7.65%, or, you know, then you're paying $7,650, which is and I'm sounding repetitive, but I want to illustrate a point. You're paying $7,650, which is 7.65% of your $100,000 that you make. But a wealthy person who's making $1 million a year still pays slightly more than $7,650. So their percentage rate, it's less than 1%. It's only 0.765% of their total income. And so it becomes a negligible item for the person who's making $1 million, but it's quite significant for the middle and upper income earner, right?
That's absolutely correct, Tim. Now, of course, you know, one of the things we should note is that, you know, you pay your Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes, and, you know, you're meant to get something in return. You're meant to get Social Security and Medicare benefits in retirement. You pay that tax throughout your working career, and in return, you get those benefits. Now, and this comes to a linguistic trick that drives me batty, which is people talk about Social Security and Medicare as being entitlement programs. Entitlement programs suggest something that we give to people out of the goodness of our heart. That is not what Social Security and Medicare are. Social Security and Medicare are programs that we pay into for our entire working career, and in return for making those contributions, we should get those benefits. So anybody who goes along saying they are entitlement programs, it's completely fallacious. These are benefits that you paid into and that you should be paid out on.
Well, bless your heart for saying that, Jonathan, because, you know, I always look at you know, your Social Security, your retirement. If you're making, and I'm straying a little bit off the topic, but it's an important point. If you're making $12,000 a year in Social Security income, and if it was a private, and I'm making up numbers, Jonathan, you know, you can always correct me on this, but if you had your own retirement account that was generating, say, 3 or 4% a year, that means you would have an asset of about $300,000 generating that income for you. And I'm being very simplistic, but what I'm saying is that every American, in essence, has a $300,000 asset in Social Security, and they earned it by and large, correct?
That's correct. And so the point I was going to make before I got onto my little diatribe about entitlement programs, the use of that phrase, is yes, it's true that in terms of our $1 million earner, you know, Social Security payroll tax is a relatively small percentage of their total income. Nonetheless, the amount of Social Security benefits they get is also capped. I mean, they're going to get Social Security benefits in retirement that would reflect somebody who is earning the maximum subject to Social Security, which is $118,500 in 2015. They wouldn't get a benefit that's somehow proportional to $1 million income. So, you know, I always want to be fair here. You know, yes, they pay a lower percentage, but also they do get much lower benefits relative to their total income upon retirement.
Well, you use the term regressive, and I think that deserves an explanation. The Social Security tax is regressive because lower income pay a larger percentage. But explain, like, sales tax or maybe even property tax or any number of other taxes are regressive. And can you just kind of illustrate that just so we can wrap our arms around it?
So take the sales tax. Say you live in a state which has a 5% sales tax. If you're living paycheck to paycheck, you're going to be spending everything you earn, and everything you spend is going to be subject to that 5%. When you go to the store, whatever you buy, they're going to tack on 5%. Now, if you're our hypothetical millionaire, and you're saving great gobs of money because, you know, you couldn't possibly spend all that income every year. As a consequence, you're spending a roughly small proportion of your income. So, yeah, you're paying 5% when you go and spend, but compared to the guy who's making $20,000, clearly they're paying sales taxes relative to their income that's much higher than the amount of sales tax you're paying relative to your income.
And one would think, you know, that would carry forth in property taxes, any other number of taxes, simply because the rich can save more and it's just not a significant thing. But
I would quibble with you a little bit on the property taxes. I mean, clearly, property taxes in most states are proportional to the value of the property. So to the extent that, you know, you're some rich guy and you've got, you know, houses, you know, in Miami and Aspen and goodness knows where else, you know, you're paying property taxes on each of those, and they should roughly reflect the market value of those properties. So I wouldn't really say that property taxes are regressive, but yes, to the extent that, you know, real estate is a smaller asset for you than it is for somebody on a lower income, then to some extent, yeah, there is that regressive aspect to it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, let's do this, Jonathan. Let's break for a commercial. When we come back, let's talk about actually, there's so much to talk about, and this stuff is really fascinating. And so we're talking with Jonathan Clements. He's a Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist, and also he has the Jonathan Clements Money Guide, 2015 Money Guide, which we'll provide a link on our show. And I encourage you to take a look at that. It's good stuff, and you're listening to him here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back. Our government should be open. It must be accountable to the people. And we demand access to vote and our votes be counted and verified. These concepts should be common sense in our democracy, but they're not. Some would deny us these rights. But people died for them, and Common Cause works every day to make certain they did not die in vain. Join Common Cause. Keep your rights and hold political power accountable where it should be. The people. CommonCause.org, holding power accountable.
I have heard of beautiful garments to be worn by the fighters of sin. But the old garments I've ever known in winter.
Welcome to this episode of the Tim Danahy Show's American History Minutes. In 1995, when the U.S. Senate was considering the United States as part of the World Trade Organization, Ralph Nader challenged every member of Congress to read the entire treaty and answer 10 simple questions in public. Nader asked because he saw no evidence that any congressman even read what was in the bill that would represent the greatest surrender of local, state, and national sovereignty in United States history. Of all the members of Congress, only Senator Hank Brown of Colorado had the fortitude to accept Nader's challenge. He read the World Trade Agreement, sat down in front of an audience and cameras, and correctly answered 12 questions. His response to actually reading the treaty? He said he believed in free trade, but he was stunned how the World Trade Organization was a threat to national sovereignty. No other member of Congress showed evidence of reading the bill, and Senator Brown went to his fellow senators and tried to tell them the trade agreement was bad for America. However, no one changed their vote. The U.S. became part of the World Trade Organization, and all our legislation that affects business and consumers is subjugated to the final authority of the World Trade Organization. The world's greatest deliberative body didn't even read the bill that surrendered our ability to freely make future laws. This American History Minute is brought to you by The Tim Danahy Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show, follow us on Twitter at hashtag Tim Danahy Show, and listen to us at Danahy.com. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're talking with Jonathan Clements, who is a Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist, and he's also the author of the Jonathan Clements 2015 Money Guide. And you can access that money guide through a link in our webpage, should you be so inclined. And it's actually literal and figurative. It's worth taking a look at it. It's quite remarkable. Jonathan, we've talked about income taxes, and we've talked about regressive taxes and how really they're adding up. So at the lower income levels are paying increasing shares of their income on taxes, various taxes. But then it's starting to... you know, so the percentage of income that they're paying on taxes, one would imagine at this stage, we're starting to narrow the gap between the poor and the rich on overall taxes paid, aren't we?
Well, there is still a substantial gap between the percentage the wealthy people pay and the percentage that the typical American pays. Nonetheless, you're right. I mean, income at the top level has come down over time. And I think this would be a good moment in which to sort of segue into one of the more interesting aspects of the tax code, some might say unfair, I'm sure you would, Tim, which is the difference between how earned and unearned income is taxed. So let's do a couple of definitions here. Earned income, that's the income that you get from a job. You go to the office, you go to the factory, and you get paid. Unearned income is stuff like interest from bonds, dividends from stocks, and also capital gains. If you take a stock, it goes up in value, and then you sell it at a profit. Well, currently, your income from your job, your earned income, and interest income, which is the interest you earn on bonds or on your savings account at the bank, that's taxed at the income tax rate, which means a maximum rate of 39.6% under the federal tax code. But if you have qualified dividends or long-term capital gains, that means capital gains on stocks or any other asset that you've held for more than a year, those are taxed at a maximum rate of 20%. So essentially, the dividend and capital gains rate is half the rate that it is on income. And you have to sit there and you scratch your head a little bit and say, well, why is that? Why is it that if I just have money working for me, I get taxed at half the rate of some poor slob who has to go to the office every day or go to the factory every day? What's the sense there? Well, the tax code historically has been tilted in such a way that it should encourage people to save and invest. That's also the reason we have all these different retirement accounts with various tax advantages. Historically, we've been trying to encourage people to save and invest because the feeling is that is good for the economy. And I can appreciate that rationale somewhat, but I think people who look at the situation should ask themselves two questions. One is, well, who benefits from this? And the answer is the people who benefit from a low rate on long-term capital gains and qualified dividends are people who have big investment portfolios. So who has big investment portfolios? Well, people who are rich, that's who has big investment portfolios. So clearly this tax break that we give to qualified dividends and long-term capital gains goes to wealthier people. And then the second thing you should ask yourself is, do we really need to incentivize saving and investing at the expense of working? Well, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, that would have made a lot of sense, because we needed people to save and invest to help the economy grow. But at this juncture, faced with the retirement of the baby boom generation and a shrinking of the working population compared to the number of retirees, if anything, we should be incentivizing people to keep their jobs and to keep working, because we need people in the economy delivering goods and services, paying income taxes, in order to keep a well-balanced economy. So I would question whether, even if 30 years ago it made sense to encourage people to save and invest by having a low capital gains rate and a low rate on qualified dividends, I'm not sure it makes economic sense today.
Well, one would think that it would change over time, and I think historically it has changed, but unfortunately, given the current mindset, it can only change downward. And as a result, it's created some problems. But you talk about how the rich are benefiting from these stock portfolios and the different tax rates on that. But there are also the estate and corporate taxes are shrinking too at this point. That should probably be discussed too in the context of who pays more, the rich or the poor.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting issue. So I went back and I looked at numbers from 2014 and then from 50 years earlier, 1964. So in 1964, in terms of the revenue that the federal government collected, in 1964, 2.1% of that federal government revenue came from the estate tax. Last year, it was 0.6. So less than a third of our revenue came from the estate tax relative to what it was 50 years earlier. Meanwhile, corporate income taxes, 21% of the government's revenue back in 1964, 21% came from corporate income taxes. Last year, it was 10.6. It's about half. Meanwhile, the rate that came from income taxes went up a little bit. It currently accounts for about 46% of federal government revenue. But the big increase was the increase in the federal government revenue coming from the payroll tax. In 1964, less than 20% of the federal government revenue came from the payroll tax. Last year, it was 34%. So the payroll tax, which is a regressive tax, has actually become a bigger source of government revenue over the past 50 years.
Well, I look at this. There's always the people who say, well, the corporate income tax, and I just want to dwell on that for just a minute. The corporate income tax, you know, we shouldn't even tax corporate income because we just end up paying it anyway, is the argument. They'll just increase their prices to reflect the to reflect their tax rate. I want to address that one point. And also, I want to address, is there Marco Rubio has come out and said we need to end the tax, the double taxation on dividends. Can you talk about those two points and to see if there's validity in there?
Well, the double taxation on dividends has pretty much been eliminated already because we have this or at least substantially reduced, because we have a substantially reduced rate on qualified dividends paid to taxable shareholders. You know, currently, if you receive a qualified dividend, which is what you'll get from most stocks these days, if you get a qualified dividend, it's taxed at 20% as opposed to the 39.6% income tax rate that, you know, the typical Joe could potentially pay on, say, interest from earnings or from you know, the interest that he earns at the bank. So, you know, the double taxation issue hasn't been eliminated, but it's much reduced in scope.
Okay. And how about corporate income tax when we're talking about they just pass the price through anyway as an argument for eliminating the corporate income tax?
You know, I'm not I'm a little bit more sympathetic to that, Tim, and it's not because, you know, I want to be kind to corporations, but I could see that we could potentially simplify the tax code by eliminating the corporate income tax and then instead taxing capital gains and dividends at a higher rate. So that, you know, instead of going through all these shenanigans with corporations who seem to be able to, you know, finagle the books so they pay far less in corporate income taxes anyway. So push them to one side, say, okay, you don't have to pay anything, but we'll tax capital gains and dividends at a higher rate instead when they're received by individuals. I could see that as a potential way to go.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, if we could, Jonathan, let's take one more commercial break here, and then when we come back, you kind of gave me a teaser and said that self-employed people are really punished by the tax code. I want to talk about that, and we'll do that when we get back. We're talking with Jonathan Clements, who is a personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and also he has the Jonathan Clements 2015 Money Guide. You listen to him here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
Only banquet I've ever had was a piece of moldy pie.
We, the people of the United States of America, reject the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United ruling and other related cases, and move to amend our Constitution to firmly establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. Go to movetoamend.org. Add your voice to the 350,000 people who say, enough. This is a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
And I'm tired of hearing of you.
these beautiful things in the land beyond the grave. And the only thing I know for sure is that here I am.
Why? Why do you send your food money to faraway factory farms and industrial ranchers distributing through megastores headquartered in other cities, other states? It doesn't make sense. You can keep your dollars local. Help your local farmer, your local rancher, your local retailer, your neighbors. And it comes back. Your commitment to the local food shift means more money stays in the community and is reinvested here. Reinvest it in you. It's easy and it's smart. Go to localfoodshift.com. Learn how to buy local and watch it grow here. Localfoodshift.com.
And I'm tired of hearing all these beautiful things in the land beyond the grave. And the only thing I know for sure, here I am, a slave.
All right, welcome back to the Tim Danny Show here at danny.com, and we're talking with Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist and author of his own money guide, Jonathan Clements. And just fascinating whenever you talk with Jonathan, because you find out exactly what's going on with the overall tax system. And we've talked about corporate income or personal income taxes and how the wealthy have a higher rate of taxation as compared to the poor. But whenever you add the regressive taxes like payroll taxes and sales taxes and other taxes, the gap starts to narrow a little bit. And then also, you know, there is the issue that we've discussed about dividends and capital gains and how those are, you know, typically incomes realized by the wealthier people, and they are taxed at a lower tax rate. So there's a lot of issues going on here, and Jonathan has presented them really well. And Jonathan, one of the things that you said in your teaser was that self-employed people are punished by the tax code. And that kind of surprised me. I always thought it might be the other, because they would encourage that, you know, lift us up by our bootstraps kind of thing. What's going on here?
It's absolutely fascinating, Tim, especially, you know, in the context, you know, of what you just said. I mean, you know, in this country, we celebrate entrepreneurship. You know, the little guy who goes out on his own, hangs out his own shingle, you know, launches a new business. And yet, if you do that, the tax code is incredibly punishing. And to give you an example, this touches on some of the other topics we've already hit earlier in our discussion. Imagine you're single. You're claiming the standard deduction. You're claiming one personal exemption for yourself, and you have $100,000 of income. Okay? $100,000 of income, and you're single. If you're self-employed, and I'll explain this number in a minute, if you're self-employed, you would pay $30,582 to the federal government out of that $100,000. $30,582. By contrast, if you worked for somebody else, you'd only pay $25,869. Meanwhile, if you're a retiree who's drawing down a traditional retirement account like a 401k plan or an IRA, you would pay $18,219 in taxes. Finally, if you're a retiree who's simply selling stocks in their regular taxable account and realizing long-term capital gains on the entire amount, your tax bill for the year on your $100,000 of long-term capital gains would be $7,838. So we're going from $7,838 for the person living off capital gains, $18,219 for the person who's living off retirement accounts, $25,869 for the person who works for somebody else, but our self-employed person, that little guy, entrepreneur who we celebrate so much, is paying $30,582. Isn't that flabbergasting.
I'm astounded by that, because that goes against, and I think of Paul Ryan whenever you say that. You know how we all need to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps, but and move forward and live Atlas Shrugged or whatever. But yet the government has policies in place that make it harder for us. It seems like the tax system is completely flipped upside down in this example that you gave.
Well, and what's going on here is something that we touched on earlier, which is the payroll tax. So the payroll tax, if you're an employee, is 7.65%. But if you're self-employed, you have to pay not only the employee portion, the 7.65%, but you also have to pay the employer portion, which is also 7.65%. So you add it up, it comes to 15.3%. There's a little bit of finagling in there, because the employer portion is tax deductible, so it actually turns out to be less than 15.3%. Nonetheless, for our self-employed person who works his or her butt off, earns $100,000, they would be paying over $14,000 in payroll taxes to Uncle Sam, which is why their total federal tax bill comes to over $30,000. And that's why they're paying over 30% of their income to the federal government. If you're self-employed, it's really hard to make ends meet, and even harder once you start to figure in things like buying your own health insurance, buying disability insurance, funding your retirement accounts without any help from an employer, all of these things. I mean, no paid vacations, no sick days. It's extraordinarily difficult to make ends meet if you're self-employed.
Boy, all of a sudden, I just got real depressed there, Jonathan. You know, I mean, you never really look at it in the big picture like that. It really kind of de-incentivizes entrepreneurship in this country. And but, you know, I this is kind of a segue back to you. But, you know, so I guess really the only outlet on this is death. But then I understand that death is surprisingly taxing now, too.
Yeah, this is another hobby horse of mine, Tim. As we all know, you know, there's the estate tax, or as some people call it, the death tax. It gets so much publicity. They're constantly trying to kill the death tax off. But the fact is, the federal estate tax doesn't kick in 2015 unless you die with more than $5 million in assets. And moreover, if you're married, you get double that amount. So it's actually $10 million. So probably this year, just one out of 600 deaths will result in the payment of federal estate taxes. So a lot of people might sit back and say, great, I'm one of the 599. No problem for me. My death isn't going to be at all taxing. That just isn't the case. And the reason is this. When you die, there is one set of accounts that you have where taxes are still owed. If you own stocks in a regular taxable account, when you die, all the unpaid capital gains on that account, they disappear. But if you die owning a retirement account, like an IRA or a 401k, all of the income taxes owed on that account still have to be paid by your heirs. And when you look at it, who dies owning retirement accounts? Well, it's your average Joe. I estimate that probably something close to half of all Americans, when they die, still have money in retirement accounts. And that means that when their heirs inherit those accounts, they're going to have to pay income taxes. They pull money out. And it's only going to become a bigger issue in the years ahead, because, you know, what we've seen over the past 3.5 decades is this massive shift from traditional company pension plans to 401k plans, 403b plans, where people fund their own retirement account. That means more and more people have these so-called defined contribution retirement accounts, and that means more and more heirs are going to find themselves paying taxes after the original owner of the account dies.
Well, I want to bring this to life, because you're really making me think. Now, suppose I had, you know, we'll get really hypothetical. Suppose I had $500,000 in a retirement account, and I died. Would my wife then have to treat this as some sort of cash? Would she have to kind of pay taxes on all the accumulated gains that have occurred on that?
As she draws down that account, she would have to pay income taxes on a traditional IRA, on a traditional 401k plan, the taxes would not be payable if it was a Roth account. Those are those accounts where you get tax-free growth. But the type of retirement account that most people fund, the traditional 401k, the traditional IRA, those embedded income tax bills do not go away. And in fact, there's been much discussion in Washington of forcing people other than spouses, this is people other than spouses, to empty inherited retirement accounts within 5 years. And what that means is that, you know, if you're the lucky children of Tim Danahy, who has this $500,000 in an IRA, they're going to be forced to draw down that $500,000 retirement account within 5 years. That means even if they pull out just, you know, pull out in equal sums, $100,000 per year, that additional income on top of whatever they're earning is going to push them up into a high tax bracket. It could all get taxed at, you know, 35 or 39.6%, which means that a big portion of the lovely inheritance that you thought you were leaving to the fortunate Danahy kids is actually going to end up going to Uncle Sam.
Well, I know on a prior show that we've talked about, you know, inheritance taxes and everything and how they're getting, you know, the exemption. Would that same rule apply to, suppose, Mitt Romney's kids who inherit $1 billion, for example? Well, no, his assets are all over the place, not necessarily, probably in a trust of some sort, and not in the Joe Schmo IRA account. So they would.
Take Mitt Romney. So Mitt Romney has two different types of accounts and two different types of taxes that he'll face. Now, clearly, to the extent that he and Mrs. Romney own more than, you know, roughly $11 million, they will owe federal state taxes that kick in at 40%. So that is definitely a problem for the Romney family. But in terms of the accounts that Mitt has, if he has stock sitting in a regular taxable account, real estate, and so on, all of those capital gains tax bills that are embedded in those assets, which would be payable if he sold them, those disappear when you die, because the value of the cost basis of the asset, which means the value for tax purposes, gets stepped up to the current market value, and that makes the capital gains tax bill disappear. One of the things that came out during the last presidential campaign about Mitt Romney was that he did indeed have a very big IRA. And to the extent that that is a traditional IRA, the income taxes owed on that would still have to be paid by the Romney heirs. So you do need to shed a few tears for that.
Those poor people. I'm starting to realize here, Jonathan, that America is really a great country to be rich. if we could only get there. They seem to be doing everything to prevent us from getting there. I think Hillary Clinton said something, you know, where it's great in America you can get rich, but don't pull the ladder up behind you, you know? I mean, we seem to be forgetting that we should all have an opportunity. Jonathan, Rand Paul came out with a proposal. He says, what we should do is just have a 14.5% flat income tax, and that's it. That's our tax code. And I look at that, and I think this is absolutely ridiculous. What do you think? I'll use kind of a Stephen Colbert thing. Is that a great tax code, or is that the greatest tax code ever?
I mean, clearly, Tim, you know, clearly this would be a massive giveaway to high-income earning Americans if we went for a flat tax code, flat tax rate. Nonetheless, I do think that the reason the plan sounds attractive to many Americans is because the federal tax code has become an abomination. It has become so complicated that 56% of Americans now use a paid tax preparer to file their tax returns, and many of the rest use some sort of computer program. I mean, the tax code has become so complicated that people just cannot figure it out. So there is an enormous need to try to simplify it, but we can simplify it without given away the farm to high-income earners. We can simplify it and still have a progressive tax system. If I had my druthers, you know, I would toss out the all the various deductions and credits that we have and go for a much simplified tax code. I'd be all in favor of getting rid of one of the great sacred cows, which is the mortgage interest tax deduction. I think that should go away. I think, you know, the ability to itemize should be taken away so that we can simplify the tax code and so that people can get to the point where they could actually figure it out on their own rather than paying a tax preparer or paying to buy the computer software.
Well, you know, something I've always wondered is, that would it be possible just to exempt the first $100,000 of income from income taxes and then put on, say, make up a number, say 25% on everything from 100,000 to a million, and then maybe something higher, but under the guise of entrepreneurship and trying to get ahead in the world, and the right to life, liberty, and happiness, and presuming that might take about $100,000 a year to do that, just exempt the first 100,000 and move forward from there. That would seem to be a good start. And then also we could take Social Security and apply that to all income, and then we would all be paying probably, make up a number, 1% or 2% maybe, for Social Security. Does that make any sense?
I think that it's important that people have some sense they are vested in the system, that they have a say. And I think that paying taxes gives people a sense of ownership. So I think I actually like the idea that everybody pays at least a little bit in income taxes. In terms of the Social Security payroll tax and extending it to all income, again, you know, I think that we need to sort of get away from thinking of Social Security as being an entitlement program and think about it as being a benefit that we have paid for and that therefore we should receive. And if we start playing too many games in terms of taxing people, certain groups, far more than they're likely to receive in benefits, I think you do undermine the credibility of the system. So I'm not, you know, maybe we can raise the income cap on Social Security to higher than $118,500, but I'm not sure that I would want to apply it to all income, because you would create political opposition to Social Security that in some sense would be justified. And, you know, I'd like to see Social Security continue to be a sort of a beloved program. And it is indeed beloved, and it's crucial to the typical retiree, and I don't want to see that come under attack in any sort of, you know, with meaningful arguments behind it.
Well, Jonathan, I hate it whenever you're all rational and make sense. You know, I mean, it really makes it difficult for me to justify my irrational and hopeful positions whenever you're using that wisdom and logic on me. It's a rough one. But anyway, Jonathan, you know, we're going to have to do another show soon. And it'd be fun to speculate during that show on what a good outline of a fair tax system might be, you know, and let's explore what the possibilities might be in that regard. Hopefully we can do that in you come on about once every month, and we're going to have to make sure that that's one of the months. What do you think?
That sounds like a plan, Tim.
Okay. Well, Jonathan Clements, Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist. I saw his something in this weekend's Wall Street Journal, and it was something that we talked on the show a couple months ago about how to teach your kids about money. He's just great stuff that we can all use, and also look up his 2015 money guide. And Jonathan, it's always great to have you here on the Tim Danahy Show.
As I said, Tim, it's been my pleasure, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
We shall. Thank you. Okay, and
all right,
listen.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And thank you for joining us, listeners, and we will be back tomorrow with more interesting shows. Thanks for being with us.